Hey listeners, Dennis Swisco here. We are closing in on 100 episodes, and my, what a journey it has been. From car buying advice to universal basic mobility, we have covered so many topics in the automotive and mobility ecosystem. There are so many changes occurring in this space that every person and company is trying to cut through the noise and get their message across. Over the next 6 weeks, we will be focusing our efforts on automotive and mobility digital marketing. You'll hear from companies like Wonder Mobility, who are tasked with the challenge of educating automotive retailers on new revenue opportunities. You'll hear from Microsoft and how voice as a service should be given more attention. And my favorite topic, you'll get to hear how these upcoming guests view data science in their business. Up next is Warren Zenna from Location Sciences. This is part one of a two-part series. In part one, we explore what mobile devices have done to digital marketing and the attempts of companies to engage in fraudulent activities as a result of manipulating data. In part two, we get into the weeds on definitions like geotargeting versus geofencing and GPS coordinates versus IP address, and how this all affects a digital marketing campaign. So stay tuned. Let's discuss our favorite topic here at Swisco Weekly, and that is hearing from our listeners and their painful car buying journey. Today's car buying story comes to us from Maggie in Austin, Texas. Maggie is a working professional and doesn't have another qualified friend or significant other that she can trust to lend her some good car advice. She is in the market for her first luxury vehicle, and after surveying the multitudes of prices, she has decided that the best route for her is to go with a certified pre-owned car. Now, why does somebody choose a certified pre-owned car? From a customer standpoint, there are two reasons. The first is the extended warranty that the car comes with as a result of the car passing an inspection by the dealer. The thought is that both the automaker and the dealer now stand behind this product, and it gives credibility to the car and quells any worries. Which takes us to our second reason, and that is, over the course of decades of branding, the term CPO has earned the trust of the people. And when buying cars from an automotive retailer, trust is everything. Maggie poses the question to us, how do I negotiate a better deal on this CPO Audi A3? Stay tuned for the end of this episode to learn how we instructed Maggie to negotiate on a car like this. Now, let's get into the show.
Tune in to the
Swisco
Weekly Experience.
Mabuhay, vitete, bienvenidos, and welcome to Swisco Weekly. Listeners, I'm thrilled to have you tune into another episode where we're going to change it up a little bit, because a lot of times on Swisco Weekly, we're talking about the future of automotive and the future of transportation. But part and parcel to this is the ability for transportation tech companies, automotive tech companies, automakers to be able to appeal to their audience. And in the particular conversation, in this particular episode, we're going to be looking at how all companies in the automotive space and in transportation space can better target their customers. So let's get into the introduction for our guest. The digital advertising marketplace remains unregulated and unmonitored, with an estimated $19 billion wasted on ad fraud in 2018. One particular area of fraud is the accuracy of location data. By 2022, location-targeted ad spend is expected to hit $38 billion in the US alone. Yet a significant chunk of that spend, anywhere from 30 to 80%, is being wasted on inaccurate, poor quality, and fraudulent location data. Now, why does this matter? Advertisers and marketers alike attempt to not just target you with ads, but they want to serve you with the right ad at the right moment. Time and space are vital in order to personalize a customer experience. When you have bad actors who game the system, who manipulate location accuracy, who pawn it off as accurate, it prolongs the behavioral adjustment for us common folks, like me, to trust that companies are doing right with my data. But there is a new sheriff in town. Our guest today has 30 years experience, not just in marketing, but specifically the Madison Avenue kind of online marketing, you know, where marketing campaigns are created with billows of cigar smoke and the rarest of single barrel scotch flowing like the Niagara Falls. Particular areas of expertise for our guests are mobile strategy, mobile marketing, mobile application development, SMS campaigns, and among a host of others. Currently, he serves as President of the Americas for Location Sciences, a publicly traded information services company on the London Stock Exchange. He received his bachelor's in fine arts from Syracuse University. Men, women, and children, please welcome to the show, Mr. Warren Zenna.
Well, thank you. Wow, what a glowing intro. Dennis, thank you for that.
Well, you've spoken at many different events. You've submitted a lot of writing, so there's no doubt that this online marketing space you've been quite involved in, and it's certainly going to be refreshing to hear some of the history that you may bring to this conversation and then how it relates to what's going on now and how marketing can be better in the very, very near future. Before we get to that, Warren, you know, one of the things I always like to ask my guests is how can people follow you?
Okay, well, probably the best way to follow me right now is through LinkedIn. That's where I'm most active. So, you know, my Twitter account is kind of dead right now, and I don't have a Facebook account. I mean, I do, but I don't use it. I'm not a big fan. Twitter has become a bit of a mess. So LinkedIn is where I tend to share most. So okay. If you want to see what I'm thinking about, follow me on LinkedIn.
Okay. And listeners, I'll put his LinkedIn information on the episode page. Warren, I guess one of the things to, you know, since this is our first time meeting here and getting to know one another, I'm hoping maybe you can just tee off for me some either a personal passion project you have or maybe some, you know, professional project you were heavily involved in that you can just delight us with your, you know, who you are.
One of the things that's taken up a lot of my bandwidth and my focus the last 25 years is community service. I've been involved in a men's organization for the last 25 years, very much focused on the idea of supporting men to, you know, be better fathers, better brothers, better husbands, better sons, better workers, better citizens. And it's been a very important part of my life, changed my life, brought me to the place I need to be in my life. So my life, that portion of my life has been mostly about service, how I can just help other people become better versions of themselves. I devote a lot of time to that.
And what is the name of this organization?
It's called Mentor, Discover, Inspire. You can find it online.
And
it's an international organization. There's roughly around 600-700 of us located all over the United States. And it's all volunteer. Nonprofit, and we just, like I said, we're involved in each other's lives very closely, and it's almost like a you know, it's like a dojo for men who are looking to try and just be better versions of themselves. The kind of the mantra around the whole thing is who's the man you always wanted to be,
and who's the man you always wanted to be.
You know, I'm pretty close. I'm getting there, but you know, it's pretty humble. You know, I'd like to be the best father I can be, the best husband I can be. I want to be a good citizen. I'd like people to think of me as someone they can count on, that if I give my word to something, I'll do it. I'll take responsibility for things if I don't. I like to be good at what I do. I certainly always want to be learning. I always want to be growing. I want to develop who I am. I never stop developing. I certainly am not fully baked. I'll be in the oven until I die. So I don't consider myself to be, you know, there's a point of completion. It's always going to be a work in progress. But really, ultimately, I'd like to be of service to other people. I'd like people to think, you know, Warren is someone whom helped me in some way. So
Okay, so let's maybe pivot to that end, because certainly you took a step in this online marketing space at a time where it, you know, I'm certain it was kind of at that time, but I'm talking about what this is like late 90s, mid 90s when you jumped into the space. Is that about right?
Yeah, it was 94 when I first started as a salesperson, really, in the marketing space. That was pre-internet. Well, not really. The internet was actually just starting. And, you know, this whole new world was upon us. It was really very much an analog world at that point. A lot of print, right? A lot of traditional media was being sold. But I got involved in a lot of technology companies early on, and I got the passion bug for, I'm a nerd. I love techie stuff. I like gadgets and widgets like most guys do.
I was going to say, and gadget guy.
Not that unique this way. But, you know, for me, it was kind of cool to pull these worlds together. And I got lucky, very lucky, by meeting some people who had a big impact on my life. And early on kind of grabbed me out of the stupid stuff that I was doing and said, hey, you should be doing this. And I took to it. So technology in my world was always something that it helped to enable and enrich the way in which people can communicate with each other. Right? That was initially how I looked at it. So for me, the marketing world and how it evolved so quickly, like by the time we got to the end of the 90s, we were into like, you remember what the internet was like in 99, like 98, 99? It was insanity. I remember this in the city. I was working in the city. It was utter insanity. All these this big, massive bubble, and all these people were creating all these online businesses and all this promise of the internet. Yeah. And of course, it all came crashing down. But I was involved in that at that time, and it was eye-opening. And I got involved in mostly selling just the trajectory of my career is interesting. I didn't start in media where I am now. As you said, I went to Syracuse for art. I was actually an artist, you know, and I was a creative person. So I was selling creative services mostly. I was selling like web development, web design, you know, copywriting, you know, the creative services that were really more at the forefront of marketing back in the 90s and the late 90s. That was really what kind of led things. As you said, when you mentioned these cigar smoking, you know, it's all creative guys. You know, we are all selling cool ideas, which this is unfortunately.
Is the stereotype accurate?
Not really. No, those days were over. I mean, we had fun, but it wasn't like that. But anyway, I don't mind it. I'm okay with keeping that idea. That's okay by me, but no, it's not very true. What we were doing, we were running around selling cool things. And I worked for a company early on where, again, it was cool. Gaming, video games, if you remember, in the 90s, you couldn't just log online and play a video game because the internet was still broadband. I mean, you couldn't, it wasn't such a thing as broadband. I mean, it was dial-up.
It was like, dial-up still, modem, yeah.
It was dial-up modem. So when you went online, the immediacy and the latency of an experience prevented a lot of things from happening that now we take for granted. So the way in which video games were created, where they were executional files that were built and put onto disks. And you take those disks and you put them in your computer. And then you let your computer actually run an executional file through the hard drive of your computer. And that was the way in which you were enabled to get enough power to run that game on your machine. And so the company I worked for at the time, we built video games for brands from scratch.
That's cool.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So we would go with all these big brands, and one of my big verticals was the automotive industry.
Okay.
So I was in Detroit like every month, literally. I know a lot of guys. But I was just out there, and I know a lot of these the folks in Detroit, whom, as you know, and I certainly have to share with you and your audience, the automotive marketing is always on the leading edge of marketing because automotive spends so much money on it. They come up with really great ideas. And they were very innovative. And at the time, they were looking for ways to try and get young people to buy cars because they know that if a young person buys their first car as a Chevy, they're likely going to be a Chevy owner for the rest of their lives. This is not a pretty standard way of thinking. So our pitch to the automotive industry was, hey, guys, young people aren't watching TV. They're playing video games. You got to get your brand in front of them in their language. So we built video games from scratch. It wasn't like taking a video game that existed and just putting a bunch of like Chevy stickers or Ford stickers in it or putting a car in it. We literally built games from scratch. Hmm. We built the game based on their current marketing or the current vehicles and the features. It was really, really amazing, spectacular thing we did for these guys. And they loved it, you know? So I was in Detroit a lot selling to these, you know, automotive marketing guys at the Renaissance Center and all the other, the Renaissance building and all these things. And, you know, they took to it. You know, we did some work for Cadillac. We did some work for Pontiac. And so that was early on where I got into how technology and marketing intersected and how the power of this medium was going to explode. I knew, for example, that once you were able to play a video game online, wouldn't need these discs anymore. And the access to an experience would be really immediate. Of course, I was correct. I mean, I wasn't a genius. I mean, everyone knew this, but here we are right now. You can go online and you can do anything you want online. And so
So now we've moved though from the desktop to mobile.
That's
and,
right.
And so how is that? How are you viewing that right now?
Well, so, you know, and again, I want to make sure I'm being really humble here. I'm not a genius, you know. I just followed my nose, right? So when the mobile devices first came to the marketplace, there was a lot. I remember SMS marketing and like ringtone marketing, all this crap.
Oh, yeah.
So I knew this was going to be a big deal, and I got lucky, without giving a long story, I got lucky by also getting hired by a guy who started out developing his, for a mobile agency, which was purchased by Publicis Group. And I got in there early after the iPhone came out, because the iPhone really kind of changed the game. Once the iPhone came out, it became much more expanded. And so I was at the beginning of this. And so I was working in mobile marketing since 2008, which is really like kind of the beginning of it. I mean, there was no media at that point. You couldn't sell ads on mobile devices yet. So there wasn't a media marketplace for mobile marketing yet, but there was a lot of engagement on mobile devices. So at that time, it was mostly building apps, because the app marketplace was just a big mess. Everyone wanted an app. I need an app. Everybody wants an app. So we were calling up these companies. We built apps for them. And some of the apps were sophisticated. We started getting into some really big and very complex application development projects for banks, you know, and technology firms, and for, you know, pharmaceutical companies whom we're faced with this question, which is, okay, so all of our customers are using these phones now. So how do we build our businesses to accommodate them? It's a very complicated conversation for a massive corporation that's been doing things in one way. So we help them. We help them migrate from this old world way of working and to mobilize, we call it, mobilize their businesses. And so what you're getting them to do, a good example would be the banking industry, is where, you know, everyone banks from their phones now. No one even thinks about it anymore. But back in 2008, 2009, 2010, it was scary for somebody to transact on their phones. So we had to try and help banks figure out how to get this to happen and what the benefits were. So we did a lot of work with this. These are big consulting jobs. There were technology consulting jobs all around mobile marketing. And then it got into data collection, data management. And that's when things started to get really hyped up. That's when, near the end of 2010, 2011, 2012, there was actually the ability for the phone to be fast enough to be connected to the internet so that advertising could be displayed and distributed to phones directly to people.
Okay.
It's when things really started to pop in the media world, because now location data allowed us to reach people wherever they were, not just sit in front of their TVs or on their fixed computers, which you and I are on right now. And so once that happened, that's when the world really opened up, because location data really, it powers the entire internet right now, because most people are in on their phones, right? I mean, the majority of internet connectivity is through mobile devices. I mean, even though you may sit in front of your desk for 5-6 hours a day on your desktop looking at it, the reality is that the most of the stuff is on your phone, because everyone knows that even when you're sitting in front of a computer at the office, you're still looking at your phone anyway, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So we're on the phone all day, and we're connecting we're looking at social media websites, and we're clicking on links that we're sending each other articles, and they're being socialized through these different platforms. And, you know, the internet is just this place where all these people in the country and the world are engaged with content. And their location is a critical part of that from a standpoint of how to understand them. Location data reveals a lot about someone's behavior. My location data, my location behaviors are a very valuable part of how to market to somebody. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a matter of, like you said in your opening, sending me an ad where I am, which is important, and we'll get into it. But it's also knowing the historical location behaviors that I possess.
Yep.
Where does Warren, or not Warren, but where does this ID, where does this person on this device do every day? We know that they go from a suburb into the city in the morning, and it takes them an hour, and they're usually going by car, which means if they live in this suburb, that means they must have a certain income level. They work in this part of the city. They must have a certain type of job. Right. I mean, all of a sudden, you can see how location behavior shows a lot about someone. Right. They stop a lot on the way. They dwell in these places a lot. They tend to walk around these areas a lot. They travel to California a lot. They go to Washington, D.C. a lot. Right. So these types of behaviors, location behaviors over time, can create an incredible amount of rich information about different types of users, and where people go is a very revealing and very critical part of the way in which marketers can understand someone's behavior and how to market them better and be more relevant with the messages that they're selling them. So this is kind of where location data became so important to the marketing ecosystem.
Now, this location data, though, as you speak of, it's on one hand, you're rattling off a lot of the behavioral parts of it that is collected by a device, but obviously the big challenge here is that while we know this is being collected, the access to this information is very, very limited. You know, how are you looking at how to siphon out this information, or how are you doing it now to siphon out this location data?
That's a great question. So a little historical like background on that, right? So you look back 20 years from back now, and you look at the way people behaved. You know, they were smoking cigarettes, and they were eating crappy food, and they were not wearing seatbelts. You know, you look back and you're like, these people were nuts. You know, like, what the heck are they doing? But it's because, like, you know, we just weren't educated enough about things, right? I mean, we thought things were okay, and now we know better, and so we've changed our behaviors, right? There's a lot more regulations around the foods we eat, the way we drive. It's like anything. So the beginning of the internet, when it was first out and people were using their devices, it was literally the Wild West, where, you know, there was no regulation and people were just being tracked, and it was nuts, you know? But what's happened over the last like 4 or 5 years is, as the Android operating system and the Apple operating systems have evolved, there have been some restrictions in terms of the way in which data can be accessed. For example, you probably noticed that now you see more and more on your phone things like, do you want this app to watch you all the time, or only when it's on, or never, right? It's giving the user more choices around how they want the location data to be served, right? And the reason is because there's two things. I mean, one is, I think there's just a general awareness that people should know, right? They should have a say in when these decisions are being made, because it's not cool that your data is being just sucked out of your phone and being used for purposes that you're not aware of. And number two, it's a better experience for the user to make these type of decisions. So what's happened over the time, the economics of this industry are very unique, right? The ad tech industry is a complicated spaghetti of different technologies that underpin the online marketing space. There's stacks and stacks and stacks of different types of advertising technology that go into the delivery and acquisition of data points and ad delivery. And the goal is to make it as accurate as possible to fulfill on it. But the other goal, of course, is economic, right? People all have to make some money on this, or else they're not in business anymore. And it's that tug of war between fulfilling on the campaign and making enough money of all these different people in the ecosystem that actually drives a lot of this behavior that you referenced when you first started the conversation.
But there is an issue with all of this.
No question. There's more than one issue with it. I mean, there's...
Well, I guess, tell before we start getting into more of the specific location fraudulent activities, what would be some other elements about the data that's being either collected or not collected that is presenting problems for marketing?
Well, okay, so it depends. It's a good question. It depends, like, where you're sitting in the food chain.
Okay.
So if I'm a marketer, if I'm a brand, from that person's perspective, I've been given this promise that there's this new age of marketing and I want to reach people in this new way because that's what I told could be done, mm-hmm. and how cool. I want to participate in this because I want more customers. And a lot of people have told me that these new mobile devices, this internet thing, can get me new customers if I use it properly. And I rely on these experts to spend my money appropriately, because that's their job, is to take the money and spend it in the marketplace appropriately to get me customers. And they promise me that they can reach people on their phones, which makes the ad more relevant. Or maybe they'll get someone that's near my dealership, where people have a more propensity to buy at a dealership they're close to. And that may influence them to want to come into my dealership. And there's all types of ways in which this data is, you know, promised to deliver certain objectives and certain fulfill on certain marketing goals. The issues are is that some of it's really effective. Some of it's just a lot of hokey pocus stuff. You know, it's not really necessarily effective as it's claimed. It's a lot of false claims. And there's a lot of realities, and brands need to be more educated about what's really possible and what they're really buying, so that they have a more transparency into not only what they can effectuate, but also what they're spending their money on.
And so then what is this transparency you speak of then?
So, well, there's two things, right? So if I'm, there's a lot here. This is a big conversation, because you've got, on one end, you've got the regulatory problems, which are nipping at the heels of the ad tech community. As you know, the California privacy laws are saying, you know, you shouldn't be collecting data from people in the first place, right? Because people didn't agree to it. They didn't agree to your data being collected, and they didn't agree to their data being used for the purposes that you're using it for. So you have to make it clear to them, because their data is being sold and they don't know about it. When data was abundant and there were no regulations, people could use it any way they wanted.
Right.
But these restrictions are causing a constraint on the use of the data, and it's causing some problems with the ability to use it or not. So that's one side of the equation.
You know, well, and further to that, Warren, I personally, I'm very much torn on this idea of, you know, when I bought an iPhone, I don't have the rights to the intellectual property of the iPhone. And so to me, I'm viewing this as like, well, if my data is being shared, well, that kind of is part of the mutual agreement that I've entered in with a particular company by buying their product, by using their service. So this is kind of almost counterintuitive to what a lot of people fight for in this whole data regulation, is that, yes, I want to own my data. And again, I'm torn on that. I can't say I'm sided one way or the other. But then the second thing would be that even if I did own my data, I wouldn't know what to do with it. I mean, what am I going to do? Go to like an Excel spreadsheet of my data and be like, okay, I will share this with Google and Facebook and my local Audi dealership and blah, blah, blah. And I don't see that happening.
So here's the thing, right? So let's look at the old advertising model, right? The old advertising model was I tuned into a TV show on television, and I knew that there are commercials, and I get my TV for free, right? This is before you paid for cable.
Yep.
The broadcasters send out, you know, All in the Family or, you know, any other TV shows that I like to watch. And in exchange for those excellent programs, I sit through like 20 something minutes per hour of TV commercials. And I make that agreement with the advertiser and the broadcaster because that's the way that they pay for me to be able to watch this stuff for nothing.
Right.
That's a good deal, right? I watch these commercials. If the commercials are entertaining and they're compelling and they offer me good stuff, then the exchange of value is worth it. Mm-hmm. The difference today is that that's not the same exchange. Because now when I watch the commercial or I look at the ad, there's a different thing going on. They're actually taking a piece of information about me, and then they're sharing it with other people who then can talk to me about things. And I didn't enter that agreement. All I did was I just wanted to read CNN because I like that website and I look at their ads to do so. But I didn't agree that those ads were going to track me and share information with other people, because TV didn't do that. TV didn't like all of a sudden start telling other advertisers about my watching and viewing habits. They just sent me more commercials, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the exchange, it's not the same agreement.
Okay.
And then my opinion is you should be able to opt out of that. You should say, yeah, you know, I don't want that level of engagement. I don't want that. I just want the one-to-one. I want to look at your stuff and I'll look at ads. And then maybe the publisher would then in that instance say, all right, then you'll get like a smaller version of our website because the exchange rate for us is less. But for people that are willing to share their data with us, we'll give you more content, right? Other option would be pay for it. Pay $10 a month for our site, right? My point is that these discussions aren't being had with the consumer to the extent that a lot of the regulatory bodies want. And as a result, the consumer really doesn't know the truth about what's working. And as a result, it's not as equitable as maybe you might have described.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yeah. So this would be one of the issues. This is the first issue you talked about, the regulatory aspect.
That's correct.
What's the other
issue is the economic issue, which is like, all right, so I'm an advertiser and I've got a bunch of dollars to spend on marketing and I want to reach people with my message. And so because I've been promised that location data is effective, I want to buy some location data because I want to reach people that are around my store. There's a whole bunch of people that are bidding on that solution. They want to win at that auction to sell that data to that particular advertiser. But there's only so much money to go around. And because the margin level of profit on that deal is very is easily threatened and easily diminished.
Okay.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to put some data in there that's not as good as the data that you wanted. Like you maybe wanted really good, high quality targeted location data, but I'm going to give you less accurate location data because I can fulfill on that bid or that request with a greater level of confidence and higher level of margin because I'll be able to fulfill more of it. And because I'm self-reporting my results to you and there's no transparency into my results, there's no way for the advertiser to know that in fact, what this publisher or this technology firm data company did was they sold me stuff that's not as level of high quality as it was that I intended to buy. So what we're trying to do is just to bring some transparency to that transaction so people understand better what they purchased.
Now, when you say the self-reporting element, I mean, can't an advertiser simply ask their agency, hey, well, you know, show me Google Analytics, show me your Facebook reports that...
Yeah. But the problem is that the report that the agency gets from Google is being self-reported by Google or self-reported by Facebook. That's all the problem with the Facebook issues that have been coming up lately. It's that Facebook makes all these claims that they get all these results, but they're the ones checking their own homework. There's no independent third party who's looking at Facebook's results and verifying that in fact what Facebook is saying is true. So, you know, if I go to someone that's selling me wheat and they tell me that their wheat is 100% pure, I would probably want some third party like an FDA to tell me that, in fact, they inspected that wheat and that they're living up to a certain standard. But there isn't one in this case. So the problem is that there's a lot of unregulated and non-transparent companies whom are declaring the level of quality of their own supply without any third party coming in and saying that, in fact, it's true. That's what we're doing.
Now, yeah. So, I mean, from a third party auditing standpoint, then, I mean, there's no federal regulations that surround
not
that.
Yet.
This is
not yet. There may be, but they're not yet.
But so this is more where you're going to have either companies or perhaps even organizations. I think is it IAB, Interactive Advertising Bureau, kind of is serving also as like this intermediary step to audit certain practices.
They're one of them. Yeah, they're one of them. There's a numerous ones. There's the 4As, there's the ANA, there's the IAB, right? There's a number of different regulatory bodies that are all kind of trying to figure out this, right? They understand the challenge of these organizations is that they also serve the ad tech community.
Okay.
And the ad tech community, they want to stay in business. They want to continue to make money to survive, right? Mm-hmm. So the more regulations, the less profit for them. So there's a balance between, you know, it's like the teachers' unions, you know, they want to make sure the kids get a good education, but they also want to make sure the teachers keep their jobs. You know, that's a tough thing to balance sometimes.
Right.
So that's the problem that we're seeing in the industry is that all these different people probably have good intentions, but they have dual loyalties. Really, in my opinion, the consumer should really be the one who is the only one that matters in this case. But the fact is, it's an economy. And all these companies have to make money or else they won't be able to provide the services that they provide.
Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode. Again, this is part one of a two-part series. Let's get back to Maggie's car buying story. Maggie is a working professional in Austin, Texas, and doesn't have a qualified friend or significant other to assist her in ensuring that she doesn't get screwed over with her car purchase of her first luxury vehicle. After researching prices on vehicles, she concluded that what was best for her finances was to purchase a certified pre-owned Audi A3. But she wanted to get a better deal than advertised. We went through a line of questioning with Maggie so that she fully understood the benefits of what a CPO car can do for her. And to take it one step further, we juxtaposed a non-CPO Audi A3 with similar options and miles to the CPO she was considering. Upon analyzing both prices, she concluded that the CPO was worth more money for her to invest in. Now, mind you, the CPO being worth more money to Maggie is a subjective statement. We discussed short-term versus long-term car ownership, and it is these types of questions to think about when comparing a CPO versus non-CPO. Because Maggie found the CPO Audi A3 to be of higher value, and then to minimize a painful negotiation, we advised her to ask for at least $1,000 off the asking price and have the dealer commit to it by phone. Maggie called the dealer, she asked for $1,000 less, and the dealer agreed. Maggie's car buying scenario is not a one-size-fits-all approach. There is an art to negotiating, and sometimes that negotiation starts with the car buyer himself or herself before it gets to the dealer. Listeners, if you have any car buying or selling questions, send us a note at wiscoweeklypod.com. Not only are we happy to help, but it is our duty to do so. We can help manage your car buying experiences, and then we can even start to educate you on a variety of money management tips. So, outreach to us for questions by visiting our website and sign up for our email list so that you can stay educated on the automotive and mobility space. Again, thanks for tuning in, and be sure to subscribe to Wisco Weekly to catch part 2 of this episode with Warren Zenna.